What if healthcare's administrative burden isn't actually a technology problem? My guest, Dan O'Neill, argues that most administrative friction was readily accessible through the technology of 10 to 20 years ago, but persists because these are business model problems, not computational ones. Dan spent 15 years in health technology, probably more at this point, and also worked as Senate Health Committee staff. Now at Pine Park Health, he sees firsthand how much administrative complexity is actually optional. This is The Policy Stack. I'm Lisa Berry, and today we're asking, is AI solving the wrong problem entirely? Hi, Dan.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So nice to see you here, even though we're in the same city. Here we are on recording this podcast virtually. I would love to talk to you about your career journey, which I've been a tiny part of, sort of your path from health tech executive to a brief stint and then a long future as a policy wonk and back to health tech. So tell me more. We worked together at the infamous Practice Fusion. And, would love to hear, your background and share it with our audience.
Well, first of all, thanks for the invitation. It's good to always see you. And yes, we do go back a long way. It's unfortunate to hear infamous tag to Practice Fusion. I think I can understand that and it's valid, but there's a lot of good ideas and a lot of good people there. So I think my background is I started out outside of healthcare for 4 or 5 years, I think, and I worked a little bit in policy back then before I got anywhere near healthcare. I worked in international affairs and economic development policy and what we used to call emerging markets. Then became interested in healthcare and spent the next 15 years or so in this area. That's a mix of tech and actual services. I work for a primary care group right now. And then, as you said, I took about a year and a half out and went back to DC and worked on the staff of the Senate Help Committee when Lamar Alexander was chair.
Yeah, exactly. And I think for some of us, once we sort of unleash the policy wonk, it can never go back inside. And I think that's true for you.
Yeah, it's probably true for a lot of people in healthcare because right. You bump into it every day, right? Whatever you're doing.
Right.
Product wise, commercially, you're bumping up against policy.
Yeah. For me, it was like understanding the why or trying to understand the why behind the things we were doing in health tech at the time. At the time, as we noted, it was a pretty innovative cloud-based EHR Practice Fusion focusing on primary care practices. This was relatively new at the time. And then understanding, all of the reasons that we had this business model, that it would make any sense that there was a market for it. That's what got me personally really interested in health policy. And I imagine it, spurred that in you as well.
So true. And I think Practice Fusion and its competitors at the time also had, I think, a lot to thank from the policy side. They were all riding the wave of the High Tech Act, then the Affordable Care Act, and of course, the Meaningful Use Program, which again is often tagged with some version of notorious or infamous label.
Right.
But like it or not, it seeded a huge part of the digital health ecosystem, probably in a good way in the long run.
Yeah, I think it really shaped how I look at healthcare policy, really understanding the difference between policy and implementation. Tell me about how it drove you, how it shaped the way that you think about policy and health tech today, that experience going through Meaningful Use, right?
Yeah, I think you see the perhaps we call them the excesses. You can see places where policy tries to become too prescriptive or the challenge in formulating policy that's trying to enable or imagine a world that doesn't exist yet. When you look at the Meaningful Use program in hindsight, you can think of it as trying to solve a chicken or the egg problem, where we wanted to build value-oriented care delivery models and payment systems, but we didn't have the infrastructure to do it. There wasn't the data. Everybody was working out of those colored files behind the reception desk in the office. So nobody could make that transition without some digital infrastructure, but there was no incentive to build the digital infrastructure without those payment models in place. And so how do you solve that problem? And the attempt was, let's actually build a somewhat prescriptive but funded program that sort of pushes and tries to get us out of that conundrum, get the ball rolling, and then we'll have the infrastructure, then we can build the payment models, and the flywheel will hopefully start to spin.
Potentially the last of its kind, because now all you hear is like, well, we're not going to spend another $36 billion to get people to adopt any kind of technology, right? It kind of burned the road behind us. You know, all the crops were burned. We move forward, pillaging forward into healthcare technology's future. But it's truly that that feels like a moment in time that probably won't happen again.
Yeah, it's probably true. And people forget, I think, that it came out of a bill that was intended to pump funding into the economy to sort of reflate the economy for macroeconomic purposes, right? Coming out of the great financial crisis. So you kind of can't see it separate from its moment in time, which is probably true of a lot of policy.
Exactly. So, you know, moving forward a little bit in your career, you know, now when you're thinking about policies that have industry issues and challenges that need sort of policy solutions, how do you sort of analyze, how do you think about what's your policy framework for this work? You know, how do you, what's your organizing principle for the way policy meets implementation in healthcare?
There's probably a couple things. I think coming out of the experience in DC, I certainly have a lot more empathy for the folks that are trying to build those programs or that are building those programs, whether that's writing the statute or crafting the implementation regs, the fiddliness of this stuff, the number of possible unintended consequences when you're talking about an economy of this size, sector of this complexity, it's almost impossible to imagine everything. And then there's a lot of things that just aren't practical that you might want to do from a policy standpoint, but won't happen, right? Can't be done. And so you have to work within this very complicated set of design constraints. So I think I come out of it with a lot more empathy. When I think about sort of whether it's policy or a program, whether you're thinking about it at the sort of federal or state level from a policy perspective, or if you're an operator and you're thinking about implementing a program, for me, it's always, you have to understand how the payment model shapes what's possible and what's economically viable. And that may be unfortunate. We may wish that that weren't the case, but it is the case. And so you sort of just have to get over it and sort of live within what is sort of possible. And you see that how those payment models shape everything downstream, where clinics are located, the size of different hospitals, how they're structured, whether an ambulatory clinic is on campus or off campus, the size of and the organizational structure of physician practices, all of that at some level is downstream from these broad structural choices or payment models. And then the second way I always try to think of it is, if I can't describe exactly in plain English how this is going to work for a patient walking through the door or trying to figure out which door to walk through, it's not well thought through or it's not ready for implementation. It may be a half of an idea. But if you can't actually articulate that and you can't explain it to somebody that doesn't work in healthcare, that may have just experienced this world as a patient, you got to think about it again. The old sort of adage about if you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough, for me applies in spades to healthcare. And a lot of the mistakes we make, it's because we sort of engage with something at a 30,000 foot level. We don't actually imagine how it's going to play out in the exam room or the clinic or the patient who's feeling off and isn't sure what to do. If you can't put it in that context, it probably won't work.
Yeah, I mean, a totally reasonable critique of a lot of policymakers, right, is that they're sitting in their dais somewhere in DC potentially and don't understand the real world. Now, of course, that breaks down a little bit when you get down to the state level, right? People making laws and policies are often right there in the same communities, but certainly the divide between policy and implementation remains a pretty significant problem that we experience for sure.
It's true, but I would also say I have seen that on the other end of things. You see, there are things that are well understood in DC or maybe in Sacramento in the kind of policy world or those who study policy from the academic perspective that seem to be not understood in the venture capital ecosystem or the startup ecosystem or the business world. And you also see programs and ideas that are too narrowly oriented or perhaps too self-serving, but where people just have their blinders onto the rest of the system. So this would make my life easier. I think that you know, CMS should do XYZ.
Why doesn't CMS just do this? Right. Why don't you just make a code for me? Why don't you just change the rules for me? Whatever it is.
There's a few other people in the room, right? Is the reality. Yeah.
Exactly. So you know, the many reasons why I always want to talk to you about policy, but something that caught my eye that you tweeted, actually, you're the last remaining person on Twitter. It's just Dan and writing smart things and a bunch of weirdos writing weird things. You wrote, you know, two reasons for caution in our expectations for how AI may affect administrative overhead in healthcare are that, again, most areas of administrative friction were readily addressable through the technology of 10 to 20 years ago, but we still have them. And then also, most problems are not computational at their core. When we think about AI in healthcare, right? My personal belief is that we should do whatever we can with any technology we have, including, you know, advanced data techniques and AI, whatever else you want to call it today, to dramatically reduce and cut out every little bit of administrative burden possible, every bit of administrative waste, so to speak. But I am very cautious, as are many, about the application of AI in direct clinical care and, you know, all of the pronouncements that AI is, you know, diagnosing better than doctors. There's a lot of asterisks next to that, right? So I get nervous about clinical settings. I'm at the phase right now where I say, whatever we can do to dramatically reduce administrative burden, we must do it. But you kind of put you put some caution here. And so I would love to have you sort of talk through your thesis and your thinking when you quoted this and how you look at this issue today, because I think it's a really important one.
Sure. So first, couldn't agree more that where we can, we should apply tech to eliminate administrative burden. And there will be lots of places where that's possible. The reason that I think I come to that question broadly, regardless of the technology or this question specifically, as it pertains to AI, one, I think a lot of the administrative friction, the complexity, the barriers or sort of bureaucratic hurdles that we actually spend time on as a provider group, or that health plans spend time on, or that patients have to somehow make sense of, are rooted in structural issues or incentive models that go back a long way. Some of them go all the way into sort of political or ideological roots, and they're not going to be wished away or swept away by any technology, right? At best, the tech is going to sort of soften the edges, or sort of sand off the sharp points. And I think we also can look back and say, look, if we just take practical examples of how a primary care practice like ours spends time, you spend time contracting. Most of the contracts are completely standard. You could issue these things at a vending machine, but there are armies of human beings involved at a health insurance company that it can be very fuzzy what they're doing, because every contract is the same. They typically don't make many edits, at least in the professional services side, right? The payment rates are typically indexed to Medicare. So at most, there's a single number in the contract that moves for the percent of Medicare. It's unclear why there's so many humans involved, but they're there, right? And it makes for a very slow and laborious process. You have the same thing when it comes to provider credentialing or enrollment. When a patient needs to select a PCP, when the providers need to be listed in directories, when you're processing a prior auth, these are all the things that a practice spends time on. And to be fair, a health plan is spending time on the other side. Most of these things don't need AI. They either don't need to exist by reimagining the organization at all, or they could exist in a very different form, likely with many fewer humans, or they could be automated to a significant extent. And it doesn't require AI because they're pretty simple. They could be automated with basic deterministic rules, and yet they haven't been. And so you have to at least empirically say, okay, we may struggle to understand why that is, but it is the way it is. And we now have decades of evidence that the tech doesn't just naturally get sucked in and used and displace or eliminate a process. And then the second part of the thought is, well, what is actually computational in nature? And that's, I think you see this in the discussions of great ambient dictation and transcribing. That is a computational task. It's listen to an audio file, it's turn it in to words, and then it's summarized those words into something that looks like a clinical note. That's a sort of set of computational tasks. Same thing for diagnosis, and that's why it gets tested there. But when you look at what the most of the people are doing in the care delivery ecosystem and where the hard parts are, it's not the computational task. It's often not, once I've got all the information to feed a diagnosis, figuring out what the diagnosis is. That's kind of a very small part of a nurse practitioner's job or a doctor's job. Eliciting the information from the patient is a human interaction, and that's not necessarily computational, right? Then you have, once I know what the diagnosis is, what do I do about it? And what do I do about it in this person's life, given all the constraints? What they're able to do, where they have time, what their socioeconomic circumstances are, what their health plan covers. Figuring all that out is the difficulty of getting something done about the diagnosis, whatever it may be. So you tend to see these celebratory marketing pieces or descriptions of AI as applied to this very narrow computational piece of a much larger and more complicated problem. And I think we've seen versions of that in the past. You saw this with the wave of population health analytics, where it was quality will improve because you have a dashboard. No, it really won't. That is at best the first small step. The dashboard is kind of mildly interesting, but now I've got to figure out what to do about these patients. Can I get them in for a visit? Can I convince them to get the colonoscopy? That's the work. And a lot of these population health tools had no real effect on that. That's not to say they weren't useful. They were just useful in kind of a very thin layer. And I think we're going to see a version of that for some of the AI use cases, where they may help solve or save time in this kind of narrow slice that is computational, but most of the problem just isn't.
Right. Right. I mean, I think it's something that probably both of us saw, you know, from practice fusion days, right? It is truly a process of full workflow redesign that makes you actually be able to truly, quote unquote, digitize your yeah. practice, whatever it is. Just adding a piece of technology doesn't reshape the way you actually operate in a care setting, right? It is truly it would be a rethinking, full systems design rethinking of where patients go, who they talk to, what they interface with, what those flows, when they're roomed and where they are and where the other folks are, right? There's truly how you actually manage referrals, which is a whole other area of complexity, right? That I would say intentional complexity in the case of referrals, for sure. Intentional yeah. complexity from networks and systems, right? So you're really getting at here again that so many of these things are choices, and just a layer of technology isn't reshaping how you actually operate.
Exactly. And I think that practice-user comparison or even the referrals case is probably a useful one, because it's one that everyone can understand. It's reasonably straightforward. And you can see how the existence of available technology hasn't solved the problem. So when you go back to when you and I were both at practice-user, this is 2013, 2014, 2015, I think, right?
More than a decade ago.
Right. So Gray is coming in.
Right. It's a little bit older now.
Yeah. Back then, one of the things that we were doing as one of the kind of early cloud-based EHRs was trying to build a network of connected services that were digitally connected, right? So we were setting up interfaces with labs and imaging centers and that kind of thing, because that's where PCPs had a lot of information handshake interactions that were very analog. Now you roll, and we spent years, right, building out at the peak, we're at hundreds of these connections, interfaces with different hospital labs and independent labs and radiology clinics and so on and so forth. And each one had to be set up, tested, turned on, right? It was pretty straightforward. The tech existed well over 10 years ago. The standards existed. Roll the clock forward to 2025. We're using a cloud-based EHR in our practice that has very few of these interfaces. And so the great majority of our lab orders and imaging orders are still faxed, or the care coordinators have to go log into a portal and put in an order on behalf of the provider. And it's not because there isn't a standard for doing this. That standard has existed for a long time. It's because this particular EHR, We use Alation Health. This particular EHR just hasn't invested to the same extent building those things for, I'm sure, very rational reasons. It takes a lot of work. As I said, we spent years with a team doing this at Practice Fusion 10 years ago, but a lot of those things just aren't there, right?
Yeah.
And so we're still in 2025. We do some electronic ordering and some electronic resulting, but we spend a lot of time faxing and uploading forms. And it would be very recognizable to somebody working in a medical practice 20 years ago.
You're like, what changed? What dramatically right. changed? The workflows are still so similar.
It's not the absence of the available technology. We solved it in 2015. It could have probably been solved in 2005. Maybe that was a little early because you needed the cloud and all that, but it could have been solved long before 2025, certainly. Right?
Yeah. And as you know, like Innovacer does all that work to connect those hundreds and hundreds of data sources, but it only makes sense at a large enterprise level for that yeah. amount of effort, right? I mean, of course, there are exceptions, but that is a huge amount of work, right? That is a sure. non-trivial amount of work to set up and maintain over many complex care settings and enterprise connections,
yeah.
right? It is non-trivial today because we've made it that way, right? Because we've accepted, yeah. well, this is just how it's going to be.
That's part of it. But it's also, I think, if you go back to root causes, you'd say, well, it's partially because we have this giant many-to-many healthcare system, and that's not going
right.
away anytime soon. Some of that's rooted in the structure of our broader economy. Sometimes some of it's rooted in the, you know, just the size of the sector and so on and so forth, right?
Yeah. There were a couple of examples we had here about, you know, how long it takes Medicare to process claims versus the long tail of other types of payers
yeah.
and also the complexity around provider enrollment and how enrollment and credentialing is a whole nother sort of ball of wax. I don't know what it says, the complex issue, right? These are just a couple other examples of these like big administrative areas. Like anything to say about those two examples?
Yeah, I think those are also good use case or good cases because that's what actually chews up all the time, at least for a medical practice.
Right,
and
right.
keep in mind, if it's chewing up time for us, there's tens of thousands of other practices that are experiencing the same thing. And then there's folks on the other side of those interactions and health plans and whatnot. So I think the provider enrollment or credentialing thing is another good example. It's look, this is at a core level, you're updating a database and you can update a database with a web page. Right, which is more or less how it works at both CMS, where you're putting a bunch of provider information into a web form and they're processing it. They're checking against some list to make sure you're not a criminal, to make sure your license is valid in the state of wherever you say it's valid. And the same thing happens if you go through the process for at least some of the larger, more modern carriers, right? If you go through provider enrollment for Aetna, it's a pretty modern experience. You fill out a web form. It's pretty straightforward. They pull information from some databases. You're usually good to go. It's pretty quick. But the long tail is what chews up all the time, right? Because
right.
while Medicare can do this in a couple of weeks, typically, we have payers that'll take 90 days. We have
wow.
payers where we finished credentialing. Scan, for example, we finished credentialing 2 years later. They still hadn't updated the directory, right? Now that's
wow.
there's explicit regulations that they're not following, right? The CMS standard is a 30-day window to update the directory, but
wow,
but it's not intent, right? Nobody intends for it to be painful. It's just maybe there's not super strong motivation in the team that's responsible. It's manual at three layers behind the firewall in a way that we couldn't perceive without working at that particular organization. And then they've added complexity for business process reasons. They decided to outsource this part of the process, but not this part. And maybe that's not working super smoothly. So now the practice in this case has to navigate each of those layers. And you sort of see this all the way down. You see this when you're trying to get the provider enrolled or credentialed, then you see it when you're trying to get the directory updated, then the patients experience it often with our help when they're trying to choose a PCP. But I personally just spent 45 minutes with a couple in San Diego trying to choose their PCP from Humana. It's not simple. It's a lot of time on hold. You have to talk to multiple people. One of the patients in this case has Parkinson's. He's struggling to, you know, read out his number repeatedly to the Humana rep that's demanding he read it repeatedly. You know, it's like these are just human things in the world. And And they just sort of aren't built for smooth navigation at these organizations. And then the problem is, if it's one organization, you know, CMS has its inefficiencies, but it's sort of one large organization. The problem is you take whatever the inefficiency is, and then you multiply it by the 900 payers in the US, or the 20 to 50 that any typical practice would deal with. And that quickly gets bad. Even if the top couple are pretty efficient, and let's say CMS, Aetna, UHC, PPO sort of arrangements are all going to be pretty straightforward, but then you've got this long tail. And the reality is, for a practice, if I want a provider to start in a clinic or going to see patients in the home, they can't show up and see some of the patients. I can't have them on the schedule, right, and have the administrative staff say, well, this is a UHC HMO patient, so they can't see Sally Smith. They need to see Alex Jones, right? And that adds insane complexity, but that's what you get if one payer entity gets the job done in 2 weeks and another payer entity takes 4 months to accomplish the same duplicate, right, task at a different organization. The practice then has to deal with all of that. And it, right, gets, it sort of gets out of hand. And so the only way you end up doing it is you sort of add support staff layers. And that is what we mean by,
and that's your administrative cost.
That's the administrative cost. Exactly. Right.
That's literally cost, because you're obviously trying to maximize the time of the clinician, of the physician, or the nurse practitioner, or advanced provider, because you want to spend all of their time on literally delivering direct patient care and not doing all of the credentialing and the administrative, yeah, burden and the reporting and whatever else it is. It's just, it's interesting. You talked a little bit about, we've chatted a little bit about value-based care processes, right? On the one hand, we say, okay, value-based care, the sort of typical thing you would imagine is some kind of PM per member, yeah, per month payment, and maybe a potentially streamlined approach about how you would report. But of course, you say that there's incredible administrative complexity in value-based care contracting. Maybe back up like one little bit and just explain a little bit more about how Pine Park Health operates, because we kind of, sure, skipped over that. I know, but maybe the audience doesn't know. And then talk a little bit about what kind of administrative complexities are included in value-based care contracting that are probably not being addressed by AI tools.
Sure. Yeah. So the start, this is good context. So Pine Park Health is a primary care practice. We operate in California, both Northern and Southern California, as well as Arizona and Nevada, both Northern and Southern Nevada. And our particular model of care is in-home primary care for seniors. We deliver that through embedded in-home care programs in senior living communities. So think of these as campuses or apartment buildings that are built for seniors, 55 plus, 65 plus, or in a lot of cases, assisted living. They're sort of further on. They're not medical facilities. So they are just residences, but they're organized and usually staffed to provide additional support for folks as they age. We go in and, in partnership with those buildings or the operators of the buildings, we set up embedded in-home primary care programs. And then, to your point, we do it as much as possible under a value-based care framework. We're bringing the primary care to the senior in the hopes of keeping the senior healthier in the home that they've chosen and not heading out to the ER, ending up in the SNF, so on and so forth. And so on the payer side or the health insurance side, wherever possible, we try to do it under value-based care arrangements. And we participate in the CMS ACO programs. We also participate in full risk arrangements with Medicare Advantage plans. So then, to your question, I think this is something that I was affirmatively wrong about earlier in my career. I think I hoped, perhaps is the better word, that at least some forms of value-based care, to your point about a PMPM capitation, might be simpler and might consequently be more efficient to operate.
Isn't that the goal? You're not billing fee for service. You're just getting, right, one payment. You're at risk to make their health better and the quality better. And there you go.
And this was, I think I imagined that this would, at least some form of this would right, be possible. I think this is one where it's just not the case. It's just, having done this now and seen it at other groups, it's just not the case. What, for a couple of reasons. One is, in the vast majority of cases, the value-based care framework is on top of a fee-for-service day-to-day payment model, right? And CMS programs, right, all almost all work this way, where you continue to see patients, document the encounter, submit the claim, code it correctly, get your payment, you know, your $85, whatever it is for that level three visit. And then at the end of the year, or sometime after the end of the year, there's a reconciliation where we look at the total cost for your patients versus a benchmark, and you get some portion of the savings. A lot of our Medicare Advantage contracts work the same way. Sometimes there's partial true-ups, and sometimes there's additional capitation payments built in. But at the end of the day, you still have to do all of the motion, all of the mechanics of any other practice. And then you also have to do the things that a fee-for-service practice doesn't necessarily have to care about. You have to think about the quality measures. You have to think about documenting the care that your patients receive differently, because a lot of quality measures, the question isn't so much whether somebody is got the colonoscopy or not, it's whether it's been documented, right? Or it's not whether their diabetes is well controlled. It's, did you drop the CPT-2 code that says their diabetes is well controlled? And if not, you didn't meet the measure, right? And so these are things that if you're fee-for-service practice and you don't care about your quality measures, you don't have to pay attention to. Value-based care practice does. Similarly, for risk coding, like it or not, if we're going to pay somebody some lump sum, or we're going to measure them against a benchmark, we have to know how sick their patients are. And so for all the gaming and shenanigans that can go on, risk adjustment is necessary to run any of these programs, or to run, frankly, a functional insurance market. And that means you have to care about things that you don't have to care about if you're just running a fee-for-service practice. Essentially, you have to care about ICD codes just as much as you do CPT codes. If you're a fee-for-service practice, you can sort of mostly ignore the ICD coding. So for all those reasons, there's more to worry about. And some of those things are documentation, and some of those things are actual care delivery complexity. Even in the case of a capitated rate, one of the things I learned was, and you sort of learn by doing, which is when you go, imagine a simple cap rate, $100 or $150 PMPM for primary care. One, if it's not risk adjustment rested, you've already got a problem. Because you and I, the level of primary care that we need is very different from what an 85-year-old in assisted living needs. So you have to have some way of adjusting that capitation rate. So that means already you do have to care about ICD coding. Then the second one is when you decide to go down the capitation path, you have to have some way of handing out the money. Who gets the monthly payment? What happens if the patient switches their doctor in the middle of the month? What happens if the patient is out of town and goes to a different PCP or just needs to go to a different PCP? And so what you find is that these contracts have these very heavyweight administrative mechanisms around assignment and attribution, which is all about figuring out who gets which chunk of the money up front, sort of prospectively, which can add a lot of complexity. And in fee-for-service,
and then it implies reconciliation, right?
Implies reconciliation.
If you have an attribution model, you inherently have to have a reconciliation model for when something changes, like you just said.
For sure. And then everybody has to navigate it, right? And so, right. You know, the 45-minute call I described with Humana, that's a standard part of the member experience for anybody participating in an HMO plan. And if you are participating in some of these delegated HMO plans that exist in California, Nevada, a little bit in Arizona, the complexity is even more because you choose your PCP and that determines which specialists you can see, which are a subset of the specialists that are actually contracted with your plan that's often not visible to you when you choose your plan. And this all needs to be navigated, right? And we've just seen how this affects care, right? We've seen scan members that had to go to the ER for wound care because these administrative barriers were blocking them from primary care. We've seen United member that had to stay in the hospital because of a screw up in how they were assigned to a region in Southern California, which meant they couldn't be discharged to the SNF, or at least the SNF that made sense, right? We saw another patient in Arizona that spent 2 months not able to access specialists, to which they were very much entitled under their plan, purely because of an internal screw up at United. It was actually an attribution issue between UHC and Optum, two different entities at the same company.
Wow.
Just administrative complexity that has to be. Anyway, so the point being, all of these are born of the attempt to change a payment model, but it's trade-offs all the way down. And so you add administrative complexity in order to get a different payment model. And you might have a little bit less pressure on your encounter coding for fee-for-service purposes if you're capitated, but you probably still have to submit the encounters for various other reasons to document the care that's being delivered. And you have to deal with all these front-end sort of prospective mechanics around assignment and attribution, and then the, to your point, the reconciliation.
Well, so I mean, from the things you're saying, things like risk adjustment and appropriate coding, those are theoretically things that technology can help with. I'm struck, however, that it feels a bit futile, right? Like, have we added a payment model complexity that needs technology and data and analytics to help? Or, you know, do you see what I'm saying? Is this a problem that we've created that we're trying to solve with technology potentially? And I assume there are things, there are things from the risk adjustment side that technology and advanced analytics can help with. Now you run the risk, of course, of the negative headlines, you know, we're going overboard, we're gaming the system. I think many folks like yourselves are literally just trying to pay for the care that, you know, complex patients need versus anything else. But of course, it's always a risk with technology and data.
Yeah, and I should say, I don't want this to seem, this isn't Luddism. There are a lot of applications for AI that I think will at least help at the margin, right? And we're experimenting with this all over the practice. We are using ambient dictation transcribing tools. We rolled our own. We didn't buy something off the shelf. Is that helping the providers in the field? Yes, a little bit, sort of consistent with what you see in most of the studies. It saves a minute or two per note, right? So useful. Not a game changer. It's not really showing up in the number of patients we can see type metrics, but it is helpful. We're using it to read and route faxes, inbound faxes. It's a PDF. They're not structured.
Now that
in
is a problem that we've created for ourselves and we're trying
problem
to solve.
Problem we've created ourselves. But if your alternative is a human, right, and you can have it, and it is sort of a computational problem. So that is a use case where I think AI can, and at least for us, is starting to help. And we're experimenting with it for using voice AI for appointment reminders, calling patients. And if they're a little bit more flexible than the old bots, because it can be smarter about addressing the patient by name, asking questions, allowing you to change an appointment through a voice interaction. So that's a tool for us, which would otherwise have to be a human. We're even experimenting in places like we do regular NPS, net promoter surveys of our patients. How do they feel about the care? A lot of them give verbatim comments. And we've been testing using AI summaries of all the verbatim comments for a particular provider and that kind of thing to give them insight into what the patients love about their care, what the patients wish they would do in their encounters. Not all of these things will work. Most of them won't be game changers, but a lot of them will help at the margin. And to your point about risk adjustment, you can imagine applications of that could be really interesting. And if they're applied in the right way with some structural changes, you could imagine them actually bringing efficiency. There's a huge industry whose whole job is to go out there and get some NP somewhere, usually it's an NP, sometimes a PA, to document a code, an ICD code, right? You can imagine CMS, perhaps, instead of outsourcing this to the MA plans that have their skewed incentives, who then, you know, hire contractors, Optum, Signify, these guys to go out and do it. You could imagine a world in which CMS actually pulls in historical claims before you join this MA plan and now collects actual medical records and generates its own risk scores. And you can imagine some of these things. But that's a sort of systems change that may be facilitated by technology, but the technology alone isn't going to give us efficiency. It would have to be a systems change paired with perhaps AI or some other use case, right?
Well, I think that CMS has shown initial signs of life in terms of their intention to collect and also share data in the last couple of weeks here. And so that's certainly an idea. I wonder if they're thinking what you're thinking. It certainly could be interesting. I also think that the policy winds are certainly blowing in a direction that is putting more pressure on MA and certainly more scrutiny on MA and really asking, what is this program for? And how has it gotten so far away from, you know, the original intent, I believe. So it'll be interesting to watch that one play out
for sure.
In DC for sure. So I want to get into a couple other things that we had chatted about before. You know, what would it take to make this administrative efficiency. Like, I think follow the money, right? Like, for some reason, there a lot of, like you noted, a lot of people are making money either through just employing more people in this these layers of administrative burden, and billing against that. What would it take to sort of make administrative efficiency profitable and therefore favorable in our system?
Yeah, this is a hard one, I think. In part because I think of it in a couple ways at the same time that it may be contradictory, right? One is, I would argue, first, we don't want to be too, or I shouldn't be too negative. When you look, there's no question that some areas of healthcare have been automated to a significant degree, or at least the application of tech has made a real dent. There are things that are pretty efficient today that weren't efficient before. One example is claims, right? Everybody is willing to invest in tech when it's about getting paid faster. And to be fair, the health plans also made investments in that as well because they were tired of processing mountains and mountains of paper. Eligibility inquiries is something where I think the tech has made a lot of advancement. And that, to be fair, is a combination of applied technology, but also regulatory change, the administrative simplification provisions of the ACA. So those are all areas. And it does show up, actually, and I think less commonly understood. It actually shows up when you look at the macro headcount numbers from the hospital sector, even the physician practice sector. It is not the case that administrative headcount is going through the roof. What you actually see is administrative headcount is flat, maybe even falling in a lot of categories, very slowly, very gradually, but when you look over a 5 to 10 year horizon. So there is evidence that there is some impact of this, and I think there can be. Where I sort of struggle with your question is, look, honestly, I think it's already profitable, at least on paper, for some people, right? So I described a lot of the dysfunction that we experience at health plans, which is not in their financial interest. Like, it's objectively not in their financial interest.
Right.
They already have this sort of regulated window. Generally speaking, the MLR rules sort of box them into about 15%, maybe 20%, depending on the plan type, that they're allowed to not spend on
patient
loss,
care.
Right? And the rest of it, their profit has to live in that world. So if they're spending extra on administrative costs, that's on them. It's taken out of their profit margin. And so I do think that that's one where I almost interpret that as more of a sort of organizational behavior or internal political economy problem.
Sure.
It's these sprawling bureaucracies, and there's a lot of people whose jobs depend on perpetuating the status quo, and there's more interesting things to do. It's not that uncommon to talk to an executive at a health plan who's sort of dismissive of something like provider enrollment or credentialing. They don't pay attention to it. You know, it's somebody else's job. It's got work.
Right.
And you're like, yes, but that's hurting your profit margins. And it's a tax on everybody in the system, right? But I think all of those reasons are why it just gets ignored or deprioritized. It is actually, that chunks of it are profitable today. And I think the same thing is true at hospital systems. A lot of them are deeply inefficient, and they lose business because of it. And that's not because they don't have a financial incentive to fix it. You know, on the patient access side, they're losing volume. But also just in the back office, right? There's a lot of things that go on at a big health system that are just wildly inefficient, right?
Right.
I give you an example. I won't name names in this case, but there's a big health system in San Diego that runs a delegated network. We participate in it. They, of course, have to do their own credentialing and that sort of thing. They have a very inefficient way of doing it. It's one of the slowest processes we deal with. It's very paper-based. There's a lot of not using the internet to look things up that are very much on the internet, like somebody's medical license. And as part of it, to try to cover the cost of this inefficient process they built, they charge $100 for each provider who needs.
Oh, their administrative fee. I've heard of these.
Their administrative fee. And at least until recently, the only way to pay it was by a paper check.
Oh, right? Wow.
So,
that's great.
Look, it's a multi-billion-dollar health system. The $100 doesn't matter to them, and it definitely doesn't matter to the providers being credentialed. But processing the $100 is wasting everybody's time. And if you're going to do it, you don't have to do it via paper check, right? The whole thing is just kind of silliness all the way down. And it's not because they don't have an incentive to get rid of it. It's because, to be honest, perhaps the incentive isn't strong enough, or they don't care, or they're doing other things that day. And these are big organizations where
nobody's going to get fired for just kind of doing it the same way it was last week.
I just think of those kind of things as like add-ons, right? There was a process at one point. It grew arms and legs and sprouted hair. And then they added like an additional thing as this extra thing. And they're like, well, why would we integrate? We can't integrate that. That's going to be a, you know, 24-month project. Forget it. We'll just add this on.
Just this like series of marginal local optimizations, right? That independently made sense in the moment and collectively start to look insane.
Make no sense at all. So like, do you think that there, if you're giving advice to our great policymakers, you know, what policy interventions either at the state or the local or the health plan or the federal level, whatever else it is, that could really force or very strongly nudge more of this simplification? You know, what rises to the top for you of things we could actually do if you're sitting in at CMS right now, you're sitting in, you know, in Sacramento, whatever else it is, what would you do? What are some things we could do?
So there's sort of the big, and then there's the maybe more practical, and I'll try to give a few examples of both. So at the federal level, I think there's a couple things that if you think about CMS as kind of building service-oriented architecture for the health system, that CMS, I think, could take on in a way that could be efficiency-enhancing across the board, improve the way markets work. One of those is the provider enrollment and credentialing process. I don't think there's a great reason for every health plan, even every MA plan, to replicate what CMS does, but slower, right? It's just not obvious why that needs to be the case. Similarly, it doesn't make sense, I don't think, why every state Medicaid agency should do the same thing, because we're doing this very bizarre thing where we're saying this doctor or this NP is ready to go and see older folks. Medicare has approved them. And now the state is going to kind of look at that question again, take four times as long, maybe eight times as long, but they're not adding anything. There's no additional information available. There's no quality. There's no appropriateness for my unusual lower income folks in my state. There's no reason for any of it. And so I think that's an area that CMS could actually build and just sort of take on do it centrally, do it once. Every provider already has to go through the Medicare program practically. So why the duplication? And something similar, I think, could play out. And they've been experimenting with this, as I understand it, on the directory side.
Right.
Once you've credentialed folks, you know where they are. There's no particular reason for everybody to then have to go maintain their locations and their languages they speak and their licenses at 15 payers. All that does is guarantee that it won't be maintained, which just guarantees that everybody's directory is wrong. And it guarantees that every single health plan is going to build their own process in a highly duplicative and inefficient way, right? Elevance Health, which is Anthem, their approach to this, they've got a bespoke spreadsheet. It has, I believe, 177 fields for an individual provider. Not making this up, right? It's a massive mega spreadsheet, which every practice has to fill out just right, then upload to a particular place, and then presumably get sucked into an Elevance system. And that's one payer, right? You might, if you're a practice, you might have to do that 25 or 30 times. So these are things that CMS, the provider credentialing and the directory management, I think could potentially take on. At the state
and they've talked about, I mean, they are intending right now, I believe, to build out this provider directory. I think there are still plenty of questions around the actual implementation, lots of questions about that, but it sounds like at least someone has heard that and determined, okay, this is actually something we can and should do.
Yeah. The harder one, which I can remember talking to somebody at CMS about 10 or 12 years ago, the harder one would be Medicaid eligibility. Medicaid eligibility is a huge problem for everybody. It's about to get a much, much worse.
And state by state.
State by state. And it's really challenging. And there's a very efficient CMS eligibility service for seniors. And then it's a disaster for the other CMS program because it's all delegated down to the states. They all build it badly. They outsource it to these terrible companies, terrible government contractors that don't build good services and so on and so forth. Right. Anyway, at the state level, the big one that, and this is probably bigger than anybody's going to take on, but
look, there's a bunch of modernization stuff you can do in the state Medicaid agencies for sure. These are, you look at any statistic, claims payment, provider enrollment timing, the way they do it. There's California, Nevada, these guys are still collecting wedding signatures on paper forms that have to be mailed in. A lot of this is just absurd, right? So you could modernize the basic sort of agency operations. But then the big one is, it is not clear that managed Medicaid has any value. We've been doing this for a long time. We've been running 50 state experiments. We've changed the programs in all 50 states at various, no, not 50, I guess 35 or 40 of them have managed care, right? If it saved money, if it improved care, it would be blindingly obvious by now. And it's not. And the problem is, it's a huge amount of complexity, and it's not clear that it's helping anybody, right? And when you look at the sort of the way the dollars flow, they're going out of the state agency with federal support, and then they're going into an insurance company, and the insurance company is consuming a huge slice of it. Because, to be fair, it's a complicated program to administer, but then all they're doing is converting it into payments. When you look at a state like California, a lot of them, the risk gets delegated to the managed care plan, which then delegates the risk down to an IPA, which then contracts with the providers. It's just too many layers. It's just
California
way too
has
many
a lot
layers.
Of those, a lot of layers, even more than other states, which is very, yeah. I mean, I think what you're saying, right, is like you add all these layers, without a doubt, you're adding like a culture of administrative complexity and politics and whatever else in multiple layers throughout the chain, yeah. which just leads to all this stuff. I think that those are certainly important points. The conceit of this podcast is the policy stack, right? Where these are intersecting, overlapping layers of policy that, affect how these things are actually implemented in the real world. And so we talked about a few things, right? We talked about Medicare, you know, private payers, state payers, insurance variations at the state and local level, provider credentialing, all those things. In your view, and from the work you've done, you know, how are all of these layers, you know, further interacting to create and to maintain that administrative complexity? You know, do you have any examples of the duplication or the conflicts from your work?
A lot. And I think that, yes, I think they do a couple things. One is, as you add layers, the complexity itself generates additional wedges and administrative costs. But then there's also a political economy factor, because once you've created these middleman layers, if you've turned something into an industry, it now has a lobbyist. It's got a constituency, right? And it becomes hard to take it away. And I think, so part of it is, I think there's, you've got to simply treat simplicity as a virtue in and of itself, even if you can't point to exactly why, because complexity will beget complexity, will beget the kind of lobbying and political economy cycle that perpetuates a problem once it's there. And so that's why I think that looking at these places where we're doing something multiple times and we could actually sweep away a whole function, or in the case of Medicaid managed care, you could sweep away an entire layer, right? And at least experiment with it and try it out, right? And you see like little experiments with this. You see California is trying a version, I believe, on the pharmacy side of pulling out pharmacy contracting from all of these managed care plans and just doing it once. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear to me that you couldn't do versions of that in other service or product areas, or for that matter, you couldn't try in a part of the state just getting rid of Medicaid managed care entirely and just running a fee-for-service program with an ACO structure akin to what CMS or CMMI does, right? Either MSSP. You could do that in Medicaid. You don't need the insurance company in the middle. So anyway, I think that's kind of to your point about the policy stack, to some extent, the complexity stack or the administrative cost stack, for me, it's start by finding places where you can simply take whole slices of complexity.
Just cut
out
right through it. Cut right through the center of the stack.
Organization. Yeah.
I mean, I hear what you're saying, but in the example of California, we have so many counties. Where I'm from, Mendocino County, I don't think personally that small counties really have the people, the process, the capitalization even to manage these programs. So there's got to be, we need more, you know, innovative ideas for how we're going to serve those populations. And in California, as one example, with, you know, everything delegated down from the Medicaid to the Medi-Cal to the public health level at the counties to the county level is quite complex. We've created all of these additional structures. So, but I definitely take your point. And I think those tests that kind of go through the entire policy stack and try to take something completely offline could be really interesting to see. Definitely.
We can hope.
Yeah, we can hope. So we're almost out of time, but I would love to get, you know, love for you to give some advice to any of these health tech entrepreneurs out there who might be kind of overselling AI solutions to administrative problems. Like, how would you advise them, Dan? Like, what would be your reaction? Because I'm sure you see that all the time.
Yeah. Couple of thoughts. I think one is I always recommend that people actually do read, as nerdy as this sounds, read the health services literature. I see a lot of startups, this isn't specific to AI, but I see a lot of startups that are pitching something that is sort of ignorant of what the research shows or what the history shows. This is, I think, famously been the case for a long time in price transparency type things, right? That's not a new idea. Those ideas have been tried and studied over and over and over. There's a lot you can learn there. And it's not to say that the whole area is useless. It's really not. It's just that that you see a lot of kind of lightly informed versions. On the AI side in particular, I think get to know, I started out talking a little bit about, you have to sort of understand the core payment models and the economics to understand the shape of the services that exist today. And I think there's a miss in some of the AI startups in particular in understanding that. I see pitches or have seen pitches over the last couple of years that make no sense on the basic economics of primary care, that are predicated on an assumption of how many patients a provider could see in a day that is just wildly impractical. We're now seeing research showing how impractical and implausible that was. But I also think for a lot of the startups that are pitching that, it the way it lands for a provider group that's receiving it is, you don't understand how primary care works, not even close. Because it's okay to pitch something that's at the optimistic end of plausible, but you want to be in the plausible range and you want to understand the other constraints here, right? So I think those are kind of, that's from a sort of sales and marketing standpoint. I think in terms of the actual product, I'm no AI expert, so I'll try not to wade too deeply into that. But I do think it turns out that the integration for all of these tools is a big factor. A lot of these things is selling standalone tools will struggle if they can't plug in smoothly into the other workflow systems.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dan. It's always a joy to talk to you. And, you know, we share so many of the same perspectives about policy, but certainly also our deep interest in the real world implementation. So thank you again,
Dan. Thank you for the invitation.
Policy Stack Podcast.
It was great to see you.
Awesome. Yeah.